In the Old Testament, when somebody broke the law of God, they were stoned to death. Nowadays, sinners stone themselves to death. The Old Testament, for example, tells of a man who was caught gathering sticks for firewood on the Sabbath. And that was against the law of God. They weren't even allowed to build a fire on the Sabbath. They weren't allowed to pick up sticks. This man was caught, brought to Moses, who put him in jail. And this was the command of the Lord to Moses from the Lord. The Lord said unto Moses, the man shall be surely put to death. All the congregation shall stone him until he dies. And they stoned him, and he died. Now let me give you a modern version of getting stoned. A certain teenager was caught sticking himself with a needle and was sent to jail. And when he was released, he went back to his old friends and they helped him get stoned. He stoned himself to death. He died of an OD, an overdose. Now ask any teenager in this building tonight what's floating around the high school here and everywhere else in the United States, and they'll start rattling off a deadly list. Reds, blotters, 714s, purple microdots, angel dust, crystal joints, super grass, Buddha sticks, Texas tea, Acapulco gold, snow, joy powder, smack, bennies, blockbusters, blue devils, gorilla pills, speedballs, coke, stardust, hash, acid, morph, in short for morphine. And folks, that's just a partial list. And if junk, drugs is not their style, alcohol is in. That's the number one thrill, the number one high, the number one way to get stoned now. 70% of the American adults are drinking. 84% of the young people in America are now drinking. 300 million gallons of alcohol every year. 3 gallons of booze per drinker every year. Alcohol is the biggest killer drug in America. Kills more young people than all the other drugs I've already mentioned here in this list. Alcohol, the number one way to get stoned now. 10 million alcoholics in America, and 80% of them refuse to admit that they're hooked. Over 1 million teenage alcoholics in the United States, some of them 9, 10, and 11 years of age. Why this rush in America to get stoned? What's behind this desire to get high? Young people say, well, I just wanted to get away from the problems in my home. I wanted to feel a little peace, a little joy. Getting high to the teenage mind is about a 2 to 6 hour trip, as they call it. Usually it's a bummer. It ends in nausea. It ends in vomiting. It can end in death even. But for 2, 3, 4, and not more than 6 hours, they talk about floating through space. They talk about seeing all the bright colors, out-of-the-body experiences, getting away from the hassles, heartbreaks, problems of this modern life. I want to get high. I want to get stoned. Take PCP for an example, the most popular drug in America today. 1 gram, about a fourth of a teaspoon of PCP, can be sprinkled on 100 joints of marijuana and cause 100 kids to lose their head. The street pushers make $14,000 profit on a single pound of PCP. They make it in their garages. It's homemade. They can make it into capsule form, powder form. It produces about a 6 hour trip, and 5 milligrams or less by tablet or capsule or smoking can produce a killer trip. And I listen to these kids talk about they're getting stoned on PCP, and they said, hey man, this is quite a trip. I said, what do you mean? Well, you lose all control of your muscles. Now, folks, this is supposed to be high. You lose all control of your muscles. You have no coordination at all. You get smaller and smaller until you become just a little speck, and then you start to expand again. And when you come down, you feel weightlessness. And then because of the weightlessness and the smallness, you begin to feel panic. And when you're really coming down, you get depressed, you get a feeling of paranoia, and then you feel empty, and then a darkness comes into your mind. You feel isolated from all your friends and from life itself, and for no reason at all, a preoccupation with death comes in, and you think of suicide and even murder. And getting stoned is what parties are all about now. I was going down the street the other day, and a teenager opened the window. A bunch of teenagers went over and said, hey, buddy, you know where the nearest party is? Everybody looking for the nearest party. And it all started with Saturday night fever. But it's not Saturday night fever anymore. It's Monday night fever, Tuesday night fever, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, party night, every night. And I was watching this particular group, and this was supposed to be such fun. And I was standing at the corner watching the cars go by, and I'd been there for less than a half an hour, and one kid had chugged about 7 cans of Coors, and about the 8th can, in the middle of the 8th can, he grabbed his stomach, put down his can, and he said, "Excuse me," and he went down around behind the van, and he vomited. He wiped his mouth, and he came back and grabbed another can from a six-pack, started drinking away, and about 5 minutes later, his girlfriend excused herself, and she went around, and she vomited. All they were doing was vomiting. Vomiting. Then when all the friends are gone to go home after the party, after the discotheque, and after all the swinging, go home and look in the mirror, splash a little water in their face, and they say, "What's it all about?" It's fun when the crowd's around, but then when the crowd is gone, the emptiness, the nausea, the nervousness. And folks, it is not accidental that the devil uses the word stone to describe the high. Being stoned, let me take you to the Bible and tell you what it really means. Job talked about it. He said, "The stone of darkness." Job 28:3. Isaiah talked about how the devil weakens people, cuts them down to the ground, and brings sinners to the gates of hell, down to the stoning of the pit. Down to the stoning of the pit. Devil brings you down, he stones you to the gate of hell. And even more to the point, the prophet Isaiah tells us what God does when he is angry with the wicked. He shall stretch out upon them a line of confusion and the stone of emptiness. The stone of emptiness. You tell me it's high. You tell me it's cool. You tell me it lifts you up. You tell me it's good for you. You tell me you see all these lights and beautiful colors. The Bible said it's not a high, it's a trip down to the pit. It's not all light and colors and beauty and peace. It's a stone of darkness, the Bible says. It's not cool, it's not smart, it's not fulfilling. The Bible said it's a line of confusion and a stone of emptiness. And any honest teenager can tell you that's true. After it's all said and done, the emptiness, the darkness, the coldness sets in. Right now, I want to give a new definition to the term being stoned. Stone, as far as I'm concerned, is hardness to God. I'm not nearly concerned about how high people are getting, but how hard they're getting. Folks, I've seen some of the most tragic kind of stoning in the world, kind that ends in death. A little boy named Billy, 16 years old, told me he wanted help. And I said, "Billy, I want to know if you're desperate. So I'm going to wait till tomorrow to give you a bed. You come tomorrow at 11 o'clock and I'll give you a bed." He said, "Mr. Wilkson, I can't do it tomorrow. I've got 3 friends and I promised them I'd go with them tomorrow. They got a bunch of junk. We're going up on the rooftop. Going to shoot." And I said, "Son, I've got to know you're desperate. Otherwise, you're just feeling sorry today and you walk out on me." He couldn't come the next day. He didn't show up. Billy went with his 3 friends up on a rooftop in the Bronx, one of those flat roofs about 8-9 floors up, and evidently they'd gotten a hold of what we call dynamite, about 70% pure. He sticks the needle in his vein, makes a tourniquet, pumps his vein, sticks it in, and he goes into OD. Those friends tried to walk him around the rooftop. They slapped his face. Someone ran, got some water, and threw it on him. They tried to revive him, and Billy died of an overdose on that rooftop. Those 3 friends that he wouldn't let down, those 3 friends that he had to go and be with, left him dead, didn't even report him dead. 2 days later, they remembered that boy sitting on the laying on the rooftop, and they couldn't work an angle to get any money for heroin, so they went back up the rooftop, stripped his body of his shoes and his trousers and his shirt and his watch, and take it to a pawn shop, got $15 for a fix, and left him naked, dead on the rooftop. It was 3 days later, in that hot July sun, someone reported a stench from the rooftop, called the health department. They came, found him, zipped him into a bag, and carried him away. Billy couldn't come, you see. He couldn't let his friends down. And you say, isn't that tragic? I'll never forget, as long as I live, a 16-year-old girl coming up stage, bringing her boyfriend to me. This boy had just been released from a hospital. He had been a football star. He was a senior in high school when it happened. He had never used drugs, but he went to a party. His friends were dropping acid. They said, look, just one tab, try it. And just to go with the crowd, just to be one of the crowd, he tripped out. And he had a bad trip. They rushed him to the hospital. That boy had been in the hospital 5 months. Just been released. Had lost his mind. And he was blind. And she was leading him up to me. And he had a silly grin, just like a little child. And she was crying. And she came up to me, put her hand on my shoulder, said, Mr. Wilson, please pray for my boyfriend. I just got him out of the hospital. She said, he's harmless. He can't understand a word you say, but I still love him. Please pray for him. Somehow maybe he'll understand you. And I said, you mean he doesn't see me? He doesn't understand a word? She says, no, he doesn't, but I still love him. And she was leading him around like a child. I prayed with him, but he didn't understand a word. She wept as she took him, led him like a little baby down the other side and down off the stage. I excused myself from the rest of the crowd. The service was already over. And I went behind the curtain and I had it out with God. I wept and I cried over that boy and I thought, how tragic. But folks, from that day to this, I've discovered something more tragic than that. I found something out far worse than Billy dying up on that rooftop. Worse than this boy who stood before me as an empty shell. Because I've been on rooftops and I've looked down while kids right around me were shooting drugs and laying around the rooftop stone, and you see a bunch of well-dressed kids going to a party, and those kids have jobs. They respect their parents, but they're going to a party and all they do is smoke a joint occasionally, drink a few beers. They even go to Sunday school. Some of them even carry Bibles around, look like big suitcases. But those kids down there that are going to the party are far worse, far more tragic than those kids on the rooftop, even more tragic than that kid who bombed out his head on acid. Because these kids are not high, they are hard. They are hard toward God. They can't be reached. God is not near concerned about what you put in your body, is what you are doing to your spirit and your soul and your mind. What goes into your heart? Of course, what you do to your body affects your mind. But this generation, folks, doesn't need some magical cure for drugs and alcohol. Everywhere I go, ministers, police officers, PTA groups get all excited. They say, oh boy, Brother Dave's coming. He's had 20 years experience with drugs and alcohol. He's going to come and help clean up the drugs and alcohol in our town. We're going to have kids get right with God and everything's going to be fine. Well, folks, let me tell you this. You could stamp out every bit of alcohol in your town. You could get rid of all the drugs. You could get rid of all the promiscuous sex. But all you would have would be empty-minded, empty-hearted young people who would eventually have to go back to drugs, back to alcohol, and back to sex. Because they don't have a new heart. All they have is some kind of a new coat on their back. You can't work that way. There has to be a change of heart. As Nicky Cruz said, you don't put a new suit on a man, you put a new man in the suit. We don't need some magical cure. We don't need some multi-million dollar program. We need some young people with enough guts and enough honesty to face this thing and say, my heart is not where it should be with God. I'm getting hard. I'm getting stoned. I want to pursue this a little further with you now. Jesus was grieved more than anything else over hardness of heart. Do you know the Pharisees of his time were the most wicked people in the nation? They were as wicked as any alcoholic or drug addict of our society. These men stole from widows. They cheated their own parents. They robbed God's house. They were money changers. They were hypocrites. They were liars and mockers. Their minds were filled with evil thoughts, adultery, fornication. They were corrupt and perverse, Jesus said. These are not the things that angered the heart of Jesus. This is not what grieved Jesus when he saw the Pharisees. Not their hypocrisy, not the fact they were stealing from their parents, not the fact that they were adulterers. And he looked upon them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts. He was grieved because they were hard, not because they were necessarily wicked. That grieved him too, but what grieved him more than their wickedness was the hardness of heart. And I see that hardness taking place everywhere I go in America now. I saw it in Los Angeles recently in a meeting. 16-year-old girl in the front second seat next to her father. Her name was Marcia. Her dad, a Christian, praying for her for years. Here's a pretty little girl who nodded approval all through my preaching. I thought I was getting through. Her dad had asked me to pray for her. He said, "Brother Dave, I've got to see my daughter converted. She's in with the wrong crowd." And that night when I gave the invitation, over 800 came forward. They followed right past her. She saw them kneel, some of them falling on their face under conviction. She stood there totally unmoved, had her hands folded. And after the service, I called her backstage. And I said, "Marcia, you sat through my preaching. You sat through the invitation. You saw all those people come forward. I said, are you ready now to receive Jesus Christ as the Lord of your life?" She looked me right in the eye. She smiled almost innocently, very cute. She said, "Oh no, Mr. Wilkson, I can't. I don't want to miss my parties. I've got my friends." She said, "Oh, I'm having so much fun right now. I don't think I want what you're talking about even when I'm old and gray." She said, I hear all these people talking about how sin discourages you and depresses you. She said, "I'm having a ball." She said, "I love parties. I don't do too much. I drink a little and smoke a little pot and have sex once in a while." But she said, "I really don't want what you have, Mr. Wilkerson." And I looked at that girl and something hit me. She's turned down a praying father who's prayed for her night and day and fasted for her. She's turned down her Christian friends in school who have dealt with her time and time again in Christian love. She's been to one youth meeting after another, and she sits there bored, and the words go in one ear and out the other. She resisted the Holy Spirit. She's heard Rex Humbard and Billy Graham, and the thought dawned on me, what is there left? What can God do for Marcia? What else can he do? He has done everything. Her friends, her family, people who loved her, and she has absolutely turned it off. There is no other place, nothing else God can do for Marcia and her kind. You know what I'm convinced of? Even if Elijah the prophet were raised from the dead and a group of scientists investigated him and gave him an affidavit saying that truly this is the prophet raised from the dead, and he appeared on national television, on CBS News program, and whole countries ablaze with the gossip about this resurrected man, and suddenly he appears in the same building and Marcia's there, and the whole place is abuzz. The place is crowded and jammed to hear this resurrected man. And I should say there's going to be a 16-year-old girl named Marcia sitting up there in the front. And when you're done, if she doesn't respond to you — she didn't respond to me — but if she won't respond to you, would you talk to her, call her backstage like I did, and tell her what I did? "Please, Marcia, I've been raised from the dead to tell you personally, come to Christ." You know what I believe? Marcia would smile at him cutely, innocently, and said, "I'm having too much fun. I can't let my friends go." Said, "Turn him down too." And I have proof of that in the Bible. The rich man that died and went to hell said, "Send somebody from the dead to tell my brothers to run from the wrath of God." Abraham said, "If they'll not hear the prophets that are alive, they'll not listen to the one we're raised from the dead." Some of you people here tonight have had enough gospel to save China. You've had enough gospel to save every heathen on the face of this globe, and yet you grow hard. Nothing can get through to you at all. Now, there are two kinds of hardness. There's inner hardness and outer. hardness. Now, not everybody who acts hard and cold is hard and cold. And not everybody that acts sweet and soft is sweet and soft. And that's what Jesus is trying to tell us in the parable of the two sons. Listen to it. What do you think, Jesus said? A man had two sons. And he went to the first and said, "Son, go and work in my vineyard today." And he answered his father, "I will not." But afterward he repented and went. And he went to the second son and he said the same, "Go work for me in my vineyard." And he answered, "Yes, sir, I go, sir." But he did not go. Which of the two sons did the will of his father? They said, "The first one, of course." Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you, the tax collectors and the harlots and the publicans go into the kingdom of God before you." Matthew 21, 28 to 31. Now suppose you'd been there that day when this father who has a vineyard full of ripe fruit, and he doesn't have anybody to pick his fruit, and he can't do it himself, and he knows it's going to rot, and the family depends on the livelihood of this vineyard, and his two sons are hanging out down at McDonald's. He's with the crowd, and they're all parked in their vans. Now, I'm modernizing the story, but so you understand, a young person, suppose you've been there, and a father comes up to one son, he says, "Look, pal, you know I can't do it myself. The trees are overripe. Would you mind coming helping me today?" And that young man, cold and hard and cruel, looks at his dad and says, "No, I'll not go." That's it. And you say to yourself, "Why, that ungrateful bum, or that good for nothing, what right does he have to talk to his dad like that? Disrespectful, what a hard, cruel thing. Isn't that horrible? That boy turning his dad down, that's awful." And then suddenly you're encouraged because he's turning to his other son and he says, "How about you, son?" And this boy puts his arm around his dad's shoulder and said, "Oh, come on, dad, you know it better. You know you can trust me. I'll be there, of course. Yes, sir, dad, I'll be there." And by now you're saying, "Aha, we still have some good kids left in America, finally. Now that's the way it should be. There's a soft-hearted kid. He really knows where it's at. He loves his dad." Well, you're all wrong, because the boy who said, "Yes, sir," who was kind, respectful, when his dad was out of sight, took off with his friends, forgot all about his dad. He was the one with the hard heart. He was the one with the inner hardness. But the boy who said, "No, I won't go," was only eggshell hard. Underneath it all, there was a softness toward his dad. That was just a big front he was putting on, because when the crowd was gone, he got to thinking of his dad sweating all along. He said, "Man, I can't let him do that. That's my father." He gets in his van and he goes and he shows up. He said, "Dad, here I am. What do you want me to do?" And the Lord said, "Which one was soft and which one was hard?" Oh, I see kids come to my meetings and they sit there and their dad, mom, and everybody else said, "Now they're hard. Now my kid's hard as a rock." I remember being in London, England for a crusade. That night, we got invaded by a new gang that had just broken out in London called Skinheads. They wore leather jackets and shaved their heads bald as eagles. And that night, a whole group of skinheads up in the balcony. And you talk about a rowdy bunch. I could hardly preach. They were trying to make noise and throwing spitballs and absolutely discourteous. And I thought, now, I've been all over, but that's got to be one of the most disrespectful wild bunches I've ever seen. And not one of them came forward that night. And when I walked out, I said, "Man, this generation is getting hard. London is hard. Those skinheads thought I was a fool." And I was going down after the meeting through the basement. It's kind of dark. And behind one of these big pillars, somebody goes, "Psst, psst, come here. There's a skinhead hiding in the dark." He said, "Hey, Mr. Wood, come here." And I go over, and the boy is trembling. He said, "Man, you got through to me." I said, "Man, you laughed at me the whole time I'm preaching." He said, "That's because everybody else would. I didn't want him to know what's happening inside of me." He said, "Can I get Jesus?" I said, "You bet you can right now." Boy, we prayed, and that boy gave his heart to the Lord. And I was feeling great, and I walked down, and behind the pillar was another skinhead. There were three of them that night. They didn't want anybody else to say, and they said, "Hey, man, I feel something. You're getting through to me. Why am I shaking like this?" God had been speaking to them, because out of that group, there were three of those hard hearts that were only eggshell hard inside. There was something reaching to the Lord.